via 90.7 FM and via the World Wide Web to all the ships at sea.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Portland Renters Assembly, happening Tuesday the 21st from 5:30 to 7:45 p.m. at the Central Library in downtown Portland, and Sunday the 26th from 1 to 3 p.m. at the North Portland Library. The Portland Renters Assembly is a gathering of people united by the burden of rent and committed to housing as a human right. There'll be a chance for individuals to tell their stories about skyrocketing rents, no-cause evictions, dubious fees, and other kinds of exploitation carried out in the name of rent. There'll be childcare, snacks, and a chance to get connected to resources for moving forward together. For more information about the Portland Renters Assembly, go to kboo.fm and click on the right side for community events.
Well, good morning. This is Fight the Empire. My name is Per Fograng, and today we have as our guest Gareth Porter, who is an investigative journalist and historian, wrote many, many articles, and his most recent book is Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. So, Gareth Porter, welcome to KBOO.
Thanks so much for having me on again, Per.
Oh, boy, it's well, Iran is really in the news with this. Why don't we start with what's going on now, and then we'll go into sort of the background. But they have an agreement on a framework, and supposedly there'll be a final agreement at the end of June. And the big issue, I guess, is when sanctions are removed. Well, why don't we talk about the agreement? What do you think of the agreement?
Well, first of all, I just don't know for sure if this is going to go all the way through. I think at the moment it looks like perhaps 50-50 or slightly better, that it will in fact result in a final comprehensive agreement. But there's no guarantee of this. The two sides still have some big differences, and it's really not easy to figure out exactly how it's going to play out. So I just want to make sure people are aware that there is a good deal of uncertainty about the remaining weeks of negotiations ahead and whether they will actually result in a final agreement, certainly by the end of June. I think that's certainly still in doubt.
Well,
So that's on one side. On the other side, I want to say that the agreement is clearly very important to the interests of the United States and to the stability of world politics and the Middle East region in particular. I mean, this is just absolutely necessary. The path that we've been on here is a way out of what is otherwise a very serious threat to peace, and that is the effort by the Israeli government to sabotage any possibility of an agreement and to put the United States into a confrontation with Iran. And they have gone quite a ways toward that objective, obviously, through their control over Congress. And so, the issue, as I see it, it really poses this choice between reaching an agreement with Iran to figure out how the Iranians can satisfy the United States and its European allies, China and Russia, on one side, and get the sanctions lifted on the other side, so that there's a reasonably peaceful atmosphere that prevails between the United States and Iran. On the other side, you have the danger that things will get out of control if there's no agreement, and that we'll see ourselves once again back to something like the days of Vice President Dick Cheney, when there were threats of war against Iran.
Oh boy, why don't we go into the bad? Now, you wrote a very interesting article about America's 30-year Cold War with Iran, and it's basically it's like even if this agreement is reached, the U.S. will still regard Iran as an enemy or an adversary.
Absolutely. This is something that is not, I think, generally understood. There's a tendency to think, well, once this agreement is reached, then, there will be a warming of relations between the United States and Iran. The Cold War will be over, and the problem will have sorted itself out, and that's just not the case at all. I think this Obama administration has made it very clear that even if it reaches an agreement with Iran on the nuclear deal, that it will still regard Iran as an adversary, if not the adversary of the United States, the main adversary of the United States in the world, and will still regard the Islamic Republic of Iran as a troublemaker, this is the official terminology, troublemaker in the Middle East, and the main sponsor, state sponsor of terrorism. So they're going to continue to hold on to those epithets, to demonize Iran in that way. And, the implications of that are very far-reaching. It means that we will continue to be involved in the Middle East, not just to try to stop ISIS from growing and to try to shrink it, but also to oppose virtually everything that Iran does in the region. So, that's not a very hopeful prospect, but in the case of having an agreement, it's not as serious as it would be otherwise.
Well, you really have to wonder what has the U.S. got against Iran? I mean, okay, it's not a perfect democracy, but they do have elections that change things. It's certainly a better democracy than Saudi Arabia. And as far as making trouble goes, they're not making anywhere near the trouble that this Islamic State is. So just what is our beef with Iran?
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. In fact, the current situation in Yemen, to me, highlights the difference between the role that Iran is playing and the role that Saudi Arabia plays. The Iranians are, if anything, marginal to the outcome in Yemen at this point. It's not clear exactly what they're doing. Are they providing some technical assistance to the Houthis? Maybe. I'm not sure. Advice, perhaps. It's doubtful that they're the source of arms to the Houthis. The Houthis have been getting arms, on the domestic black market in Yemen for many years now. That's very well documented. So, it's not the Iranians who've been arming them. On the other hand, the Saudis are openly carrying out airstrikes, killing civilians. So, I mean, what could be more destabilizing than that? And yet the Obama administration, is taking a completely partisan view, basically blaming everything on Iran as the destabilizing force there, and letting the Saudis off scot-free in terms of their role. But to come back to why is the Obama administration taking this position toward Iran? In the article that you've just referred to, I document the history of U.S. policy toward Iran as a function going back all the way to the end of the Cold War, essentially, 1992, when the U.S. national security state, and particularly the Pentagon and the CIA at that point, were desperate to have something to replace the Soviet Union, which of course had collapsed and no longer was available to justify Cold War levels of congressional support for their programs and their budgets, and they decided almost instantly, I mean even before the actual end of the Cold War, that the next big thing, the next big threat was going to be the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. And once Iraq was defeated in 1991 in the first Gulf War and was clearly a shadow of its former self, very much weakened, Iran presented itself as the most obvious excuse for the maintaining of Cold War programs in those national security bureaucracies. And so, you know, I document the fact that those institutions clearly glommed on to the idea of Iran as the next big threat and refused to let go of that. And that has become a source of not only congressional appropriations, but for the Pentagon, and I must add the NSA, although I didn't talk about that in my article, and the CIA, a source of essentially deals in which the Saudis pay for services rendered by the Pentagon and by the NSA and CIA. So, you know, they're getting actual, you know, income directly from the Saudis in return for various sales of products and services to the Saudis. This is a huge source of benefit, direct benefit to these, you know, major national security bureaucracies in the United States. And this is unquestionably the primary reason why there's no possibility of the United States government saying, oh, well, we were wrong. Iran's not really much of a threat. After all, we can get along with them just fine. That's not going to happen, not for a long, long time to come.
Well, it's amazing. And then, you know, and then President Clinton joined in, kind of joined in with Israel, which has to make you wonder what Hillary Clinton would do if she ever gets elected. But at that time...
Well, I don't think we have to wonder very much. I mean, her record's very clear on, on Iran. She has one of the hardest line policies among any major figure outside the completely sold out Republican Party leadership.
Doesn't leave us much choice, does it?
No, it doesn't.
Oh, my. You know, and this happened at a time when Iran, under, I think, Rafsanjani was the president, and he was making overtures. He was happy to do business with, you know, with the West and everything. He's an amenable guy.
Right. This is one of the astonishing facts about the origins of the hardline demonization policy toward Iran. I mean, it was really established at the very moment when the Iranian government, under, as you say, President Hashemi Rafsanjani, who, by the way, has always been identified by foreign intelligence agencies, including even the Israelis, as the leader of the faction within Iranian politics that has been desperate almost to integrate the Iranian economy into the global capitalist system, and therefore extremely open to compromise with the West in general and with the United States in particular. So Rafsanjani was reaching out to the George H.W. Bush administration at that point, 1991, and actually using Iranian influence and even money to get the Shia militias in Lebanon to release all the U.S. and other foreign hostages. And that was, in fact, done. The last American hostage was released in December 1991. And George H.W. Bush had actually promised in his speech when he took office in, when was it, 1989, I guess, that he would reciprocate any gesture by or any action by Iran to help free the U.S. hostages in Lebanon. And when that was done, as I document in my book, Manufactured Crisis, the White House was actually ready, preparing to carry out some meaningful gestures, including taking Iran, basically giving Iran some economic relief from sanctions, and also apologizing for and giving them compensation for the shoot down of the Airbus, the Iranian civilian airliner. So really, they were on the road to a major breakthrough in 1991, early 92. But at that point, the Pentagon, the CIA, got together and decided, no, we can't have that. They were on their way to, in a very different direction, as I said, a set of policies in which Iran would be identified as the enemy and the threat. So basically, they put the kibosh on the first Bush administration's plan to reciprocate and thus open up a channel of communication which you know normally you'd expect it to result in some political dialogue and warming of relations. And it's been really on that same track ever since then.
Well, we are talking with Gareth Porter, investigative journalist and historian and author of Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. You know, makes you think that maybe the West, the U.S. and Israel would actually prefer somebody like Ahmadinejad being president of Iran.
Well, I mean, not only is it clear that they would, I mean, the hardliners in the United States and in Israel certainly would love to have an Ahmadinejad in power, but, you know, the Israeli officials have been quoted as saying, you know, he was a godsend to us. So, you know, there's no question, no ambiguity about that.
Then you have somebody, I think it was Thomas Friedman, was saying something that he sort of said, maybe we should think about arming the Islamic State, that they are sort of, I guess, preferable to Iran. That's an amazing thought right there.
Well, I mean, you know, Friedman has always had this side to him, which was a partisan of Israeli interests, and I think this is one of the expressions of that. You know, it's the same as before and during the Iraq War, when he was just as enthusiastic about that adventure as many Israelis were, and the Israelis were happy to support it at that point as being very much in their interest. So, I mean, this is really not that surprising that Friedman would take that position. Once in a while, he can be reasonable, but most of the time, it's the same old stuff. I mean, mm-hmm. Very predictable.
Do you think there are any deeper connections between the West and Islamic State? I mean, you hear people talk about it, and I don't know. I mean, what do you think?
No, I don't think that I don't buy the idea that the United States or you know other Western powers were directly involved in somehow creating the Islamic State or nurturing it deliberately. On the other hand, of course, they you know the war in Iraq was directly responsible, not directly, indirectly responsible for the creation of the Islamic State, and it is an absolute fact that the leaders of the Islamic State got together and began to plan their action to create the Islamic State when they were all in prison in Abu Ghraib in Iraq. So, you know, it was courtesy of the United States that they were brought together mm-hmm. in that prison. But I'm not suggesting, I don't think it's credible that the U.S. military deliberately thought, oh, we'll be clever and we'll create an Islamic State as a target for the future.
Well, they certainly try to be clever sometimes, but it's more of a blowback thing than a deliberate...
It is blowback, yeah, and I think that's really the headline here.
Well, you know, maybe you can help clear up one question that's been on my mind for a long time, is that, you know, when the Shah fell and the clergy took over... didn't the U.S. provide the Iranian government, the new rulers, with a kind of a hit list of leftists to dispose of?
That's correct, yes. Going all the way back to 1954-55 period, the CIA was very deeply involved in an effort to essentially, not ethnically cleanse, but politically cleanse Iran of all leftist, particularly communist-oriented activists, and they were very actively involved in helping the SAVAK, the secret service, secret police organization of the Shah, once he was in power, to carry out a purge that resulted in imprisonment and execution of a large number of activists. So that was definitely a conscious policy. It was quite successful. It consolidated the rule of the Shah and made it possible for the Shah to essentially wield a degree of power that had been unknown in Iran previously. This was entirely, or largely at least, due to the active and conscious policy and support of the United States.
So they'd rather have dictators or religious fanatics in power than some kind of secular leftists. You know, something like this happened in the Iraq also, where the CIA, I guess what I hear, they paid a young thug named Saddam Hussein to try and assassinate the ruler of Iraq, General Qasem, who was, you know, a military leftist who overthrew the king.
Well, that's right. Of course, Saddam Hussein was himself a secularist, not a religious, not an Islamist.
He turned out
at all
to be a real dictator, though.
But you are correct that there was, in fact, a broad policy carried out over a period of years on the part of the United States during the Cold War to use Islamist forces as a tool to try to destroy or weaken the secular nationalist elements throughout the Middle East. And Robert Dreyfus has a very good book which documents that in great detail.
Well, what do you think will happen now? I mean, if I was going to ask you earlier, suppose this agreement, the nuclear agreement, falls apart. What happens then? I mean, it's...
Well, I mean, I think on one hand, you know, you have President Barack Obama, you know, doing his best to hold off the forces of war against Iran, and he does have the tools to do that as long as he's president. But beyond the Obama administration, then it becomes a very different question. We have no idea what the next administration is going to look like. If a Republican were to be elected, then, you know, the situation, you know, clearly instantly becomes much more dangerous with regard to Iran.
Or if Hillary Clinton is elected.
Now, you know, I think that the U.S. military, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, would lay down the law to a Republican president or a Democratic president and make it clear that they would not, not only would they not favor any military force against Iran, but that they would, you know, they would take steps to make it much more difficult, if not impossible. And I, you know, I would go back again to the year 2007, 2008, when William Fallon, Fox Fallon, was the commander of CENTCOM, the Central Region Command, in charge of all U.S. forces in the Middle East. And he did, in fact, take that position as the CENTCOM commander, and virtually made it impossible for the Bush administration to plan to carry out any military operations, offensive, you know, aggressive operations against Iran. And I think, you know, that the military and the Pentagon do, in fact, represent a significant a break on any president. But nevertheless, you have to, you know, understand that it would be an extremely unpredictable situation, very dangerous situation.
Well, apparently some elements in the Israeli military and intelligence are saying the same thing. And then a longtime Israeli observer like Uri Avneri, he's been saying flat out, there will be no war with Iran. No ifs, ands, and buts. And he's...
Well, that's what I've said in my book, Manufactured Crisis. I document the case that this whole threat of an Israeli war against Iran from the very beginning has been a ruse, it's been a bluff, it's been used to try to maneuver the United States and other world powers to do something to weaken Iran, if not to use force against Iran, to prevent it, as the Israelis put it, to prevent Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. But in fact, what it means, what they meant was, you know, we want Iran to be basically stripped of all of its power, its economic and military power. So the Israelis have been using that threat as a diplomatic maneuver, not just from the beginning of the Netanyahu government in 2009 when he was reelected, but going back years before that, I mean, I show that in 2008, for example, the government that was in power then carried out a very elaborate ruse to convince the world that they intended to or were planning to carry out an offensive, air offensive against Iran, unless something was done to stop the Iranian nuclear program. And I was convinced, by the way, I will admit it, in 2008 I was quite alarmed by that. The New York Times had front page story, and Financial Times had a two-page spread on the danger of war. I was convinced that, that we were facing a crisis, but it turns out that that was all a ruse that that the Israeli government carefully planted. So, and then even if you go back to the 1990s, they were doing it then. They were threatening war against Iran even during the first Netanyahu administration, mm-hmm. 1996 to 99. So this goes back a long way, and it never should have been taken that seriously. And it was allowed by very not very careful or accurate news reporting to become a general conviction that, oh gosh, unless we do something to stop the Iranian nuclear program, the Israelis may well, you know, start a war in the Middle East, and that would be terrible.
Well, you know, Iran seems to be doing pretty well without a bomb, and we seem to think that sanctions that without us, the Iran will just kind of wither away or something. But what if Iran joins up with Russia and China? That seems very much a possibility.
Well, there are fundamental sort of historical strategic reasons why I don't think you're going to see an alliance between Russia and Iran. I mean,
really?
These are two countries mm-hmm. that don't trust one another, mm-hmm. Going back for a long, long time. And I mean, in a way, it reminds me a bit of the relationship between China and Vietnam during the Cold War, and you know, a relationship that, of course, has continued to be rocky since then. And so I don't think that that's very likely at all. And of course, China, will indeed continue to have friendly relations with Iran, particularly economic relations. But on the other hand, the Chinese have, at least up to now, tended not to strike out and have a diplomatic, political policy toward Iran that differs from that of Russia. So there seems to be a close relationship there in terms of their two Iran policies. But I do think that the key point that you started with in your question was, whether in fact there's any reason to believe that Iran wants or needs a nuclear weapon. And I have to say that Iran really is unique in this one respect. That is that this is the only country in the world that has consistently argued publicly both a religious and a practical strategic argument or set of arguments against having nuclear weapons, mm-hmm. arguing that they are not in the interests of the country and that they are not even illicit, they are not legal or permissible in Islam. And this, of course, is due to the unique role of the supreme leader as the guardian jurist, as they put it, of the regime. That is to say, the person who makes judgments on key political and foreign policy or military policy decisions based on his reading of Islam, of Islamic principles. And, it's because of the unique character of Shia Islam and its jurisprudence that you have a policy that is so consistently against weapons of mass destruction on the part of Iran.
Well, I think we'll have to end it on that note. It's certainly something we really have to keep our eye on between now and the end of June, if not beyond that. We've been talking with Gareth Porter, investigative journalist and historian. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me again.
I think we'll probably be talking to you some more in the future. This issue just keeps growing, doesn't it?
Keeps on going, that's for sure.
Okay, thank you very much, Gareth Porter. And stay tuned for Air Cascadia.
That's right. We're just minutes away from Air Cascadia here on the Boo KBOO Portland. We're also 15 minutes away from Flashpoints today, featuring another installment of the Battle for Public Education in the 21st Century and the weekly broadcast of the Electronic Intifada. At 11 on Between the Covers, first-time author Marian Palaya discusses her novel, The Given World, which tells the story of a young woman whose life is haunted by her brother's disappearance in Vietnam. And at 11:30 on the Radio Zine, host Lisa Loving speaks with journalist, author, and documentary filmmaker John Ronson about his latest book, So You've Been Publicly Shamed. That's all coming up after Chris Andre hosting Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary next on KBOO. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support for community radio. If you are not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate today.
Portland school board elections are May 19th. What's your question?
I'm Sharon Maxwell. I am a native of Portland, Oregon, born and raised in Northeast Portland. I am a product of the Portland Public Schools, and my question is, what is their commitment to children and families to make sure that children and youth of color are valued for their ability to learn and do well?
Tune in to KBOO April 27th through 30th at 5:45 for special school board election coverage.